So we're reading from the Bhagavad Gita as it is, second chapter, entitled Contents of the Gita Summarized, text number 13. Dehinasmin yata dehi.
Dehinasmin yata dehi.
Omam yovanam jara.
Omam yovanam jara.
Tata dehantara prati. Dhirastrata namoyati.
Dhirastrata namoyati.
Translation: as the embodied soul continuously passes in this body from boyhood to youth to old age, the soul similarly passes into another body at death. The sober person is not bewildered by such a change. So this verse is very famous because it describes how we go through different stages of life. And in these different stages of life, we also have different desires, different hopes, dreams, and so on. In the early stage of our life, so many desires, so many dreams, and one comes to a point where one is building up one's strength and where one is able to realize at least some of the goals that one wanted to achieve, and one may experience success in some areas, and it's moments of victory, moments where we feel that yes, life is worth living. But then in the midst of that, we are also hit hard with tragedy, hit hard with death of dear ones, hit hard with losses, hit hard with failure, frustration, dishonesty of others who are just mistreating, and how we may become the victim of so many situations, and such is life. And gradually one gets gray hairs and many grooves in one's face, and gradually one's physical power begins to diminish. Gradually our mental power becomes less. Gradually our intellectual power is not what it used to be, right? And gradually we realize I'm losing it. And at that point, one may question, did I ever have it? Such kind of questions come to mind. Did I actually have it under control? I thought I had it, but did I really? And if at that time one can see the broader picture, if at that time one can see the transcendental perspective, then there is no anxiety. Then there is no cause of fear, because if at that time one can actually see beyond everything in this world, well, just let's go. Okay. Now I see for myself what this illusory energy can do. How amazing it is. What wonderful varieties of colors and forms and shapes it can produce, and how it can interact with the eyes, directly connected to the mind, and how the mind can run with what it sees, and write mental novels around what we see, full of romance and full of hopes, and reality is just what it is. Not beautiful. Reality is full of duality. Some moments of pleasure, and then everything disappears. So we are experiencing that. all of us in our lives, in some stage or other, wherever we may be. Some of us may be at the going up, and some may be going down. Yeah? Some may be building up in their power, in their control over material energy, and some may be feeling how they're losing their power. Whatever it may be. These are the natural dynamics. If in the middle of that, suddenly we come in contact with this Sankirtan movement, at first we don't realize what it is. We don't realize the depth and the impact of what we're dealing with. And at first we are looking at the people and we think, well, I don't know. I don't know about these people, because I don't know if I really like them. I don't know if their behavior, if their values, if their way of life is really my way of life. But if we are fortunate, then we can go a little deeper and we can see, what's a way of life? It's not all about the way of life, because the way of life, it takes its own turns and it forces us to somehow or other adjust. What can you do? You have to adjust to life. So a way of life. You don't choose a way of life. We may think we do, but then let's see what happens and what life will do with us. So the way of life of the devotees, I don't really know what it is. I'm discovering it, a way of life for me in Krishna consciousness. Because there is no stereotype script. This is the way of life for a devotee. Right? And now you live this perfect, this model life, and everything will be wonderful. There's nothing like that. No. We have to ourselves sort of figure it out. Srila Prabhupada said life is like hard wood and we have to carve Krishna out of it. Yeah. That's a nice way of saying it. That we have to somehow or other make it Krishna conscious. Whatever comes, whatever way it goes, and whatever stage we are going through. Still, within Krishna consciousness, there is a particular process. There is a path. And this particular path in Krishna consciousness is giving us something to hold on to. And there are part of that is related to vows. One important time in our spiritual life is the time of making vows. Everybody who becomes involved with Krishna consciousness is, after quite a short time, already being introduced that there are 16 rounds minimum, and there are four regulative principles. Everyone hears about this quite soon. Everyone is encouraged to practice this. Everyone who is not up to this level is encouraged to gradually strive for it. Years and years before we come to a point of taking vows. But vows are important. Vows are, in one sense, they are part of our rites of passage. As we go through all these different stages of life, there are different rites of passage. For example, as one is maturing from boyhood to youthhood, right? Then at that stage one may consider marriage. And there we go. rites of passage. Then there are vows. Then there are vows. So these are vows that exist in cultures all the way around the world. And in all of these cultures, generally speaking, what is a central principle in the vows is that surrounding those vows there is a ritual, and in the ritual they try to kind of prepare people for what is coming in life. So generally speaking, the event is marked as something extraordinary. There is celebration. There is some sacrifice. There are promises and so on. Oftentimes, when it comes to vows of initiation, then it is said that in many cultures of the world, part of the initiation is that people are to prepare, are stepping for a moment out of their normal life. They just step for a moment out of their normal everyday life into another life. So in many cultures of the world, they take the people out of their environment, and for a few days they are performing austerities. They are preparing in this way for their vows. They are made conscious of what is coming. Sometimes there are some elements that are enacted. Even in Vedic vows of marriage, for example, they have a part where in the ceremony there are different circles. If you do the full Vedic ceremony, then there are different circles which are dealing with different steps in life, and they take the couple through the different circles. So in the ceremony they're going through the steps of life. And so we also, how can one take vows? It seems to be the strangest thing in the world to take vows, because it seems A, unnatural. You are suppressing your natural flow, yeah? And you commit yourself to a way of life and so on, and you have no idea whether you'll be able to keep it up in the future or not. You're promising something for your whole life, but you don't know yourself for your whole life. You only know yourself as far as now. No? We only know ourselves as far as today. We don't know who we will be tomorrow. We have no idea. So it seems unnatural to take vows, because we're promising that in the future we'll be something, but we don't know what we will be. So there seems to be a scenario which is favorable for inner conflict, to say the least. Yeah. But still, we are taking these vows. Generally, initiation in different cultures is always meant to go from one phase of life to another. You see how in African tribes, people are taking initiations to go from, like, man, they have to become, or boys have to become men, and they are tested, and they have to go through certain hardships and so on. We see in South Africa this is still going on, although they wear Western clothes. But still, at a certain age, the boys are out of the house, and then they put white clay on their face. They walk around and have to stay away for 3 months. And how they live Nobody knows and nobody cares. They have to survive. Right? And have to walk around this white clay. And they live in little huts. I guess these huts were made of branches and leaves in the past. Now they're made of branches and plastic garbage bags. Right? Because they're more waterproof than leaf and easier. So in modern times, the leaves have been replaced by garbage bags. But you see, they live in tiny little huts. Right? Very small. Smaller than a tent. Right? If they can sleep inside, it's no bigger than this seat. You know, they must curl up somehow or other, or sit in them in the rain. And for 3 months, they have to go through that. And how they eat, nobody knows. They don't work in that time. They have to somehow or other survive. Yeah. So, and then the boy comes back, and then there is a ceremony, and then he's recognized like a man, right, after that. And of course, I mean, in these 3 months, he couldn't run to mommy and all that, and he had to face the hardships and deal with them, which is really what the male is supposed to be. A man, the difference between a man and a boy is that a man must rise to the occasion, whatever it is, right, and deal with it to the best of his ability. Favorable or unfavorable, face the music, right? So, they are being prepared. For women, they also have rites, right, preparing them to their fertility rites, preparing for children, rites of taking responsibility, rights of realizing that they too have to now become the ones who show the way instead of the ones who are asking, what should I do now? Yeah? As a girl will always ask, well, what shall I do? And some elder person will say, this way, this way. But now the time has come that they have to say, this way. Yeah. So, in such kind of initiation ceremonies, people are being prepared from one phase of life to another. In our spiritual movement, initiation is also a preparation from one stage of life to another, from the temporary material to the eternal. And whereas previous our roots were in the material and we were practicing the spiritual, at the time of initiation one goes through the invisible wall and one goes to the point of going to the eternal. And making that now the priority. And the material, yes, it will follow. But at that point, the eternal relationship has become the priority. So the priority shift is there. Just like in these material type of rituals preparing from one stage of life for another. So through the initiation, we are already now, while we are alive, shifting into the eternal realm. We don't wait for the time of death. Without initiation, such a shift will never happen until the time of death. At the time of death, yes, then we leave the body and there you are, outside of the body, the opportunity to enter into eternity or return again to the temporary material domain, as we like. But in spiritual life, now we are shifting. Of course, we see that the eternal includes this life. The eternal is not starting after this life. The eternal is also here. This is part of eternity. But we realize that now we are simply part of eternity, that this life is not everything, that we've had so many lives before. We may have lives after this as well. And this current life is just one in many series. And all these things that have happened to us in this life just the mix that we got this life, and there was another mix in another one, and another mix in another mix again and again. And suddenly we look at it like that, as from the outside. So the initiation brings us to a point where we begin to look at our life from the outside, like a spectator. We look at it, and we look at this life I have, instead of being in the middle. As children, we don't know. We are in the middle. In the middle of whatever happens. As we're growing up, we're all in the middle. It's all happening to us. Overwhelmed, overpowered by so many things. It's all new. It's adventure. It's full of hope and horror and so on. And then, right? But it's, we're right in the thick of it. But after initiation, no more. No more. We are no more so much in the thick of our material life. We are looking at it as a spectator. And now we look at it with intelligence. We look at it and consider what is valuable. What is valuable for me in my life? What will help me in my spiritual advancement? Not like, what do I need? What is my nature? Who am I? Now we know who we are. Our identity is very much fixed. Because the very initiation is fixing us in our eternal identity. Now we will act upon our eternal identity as an eternal spirit soul and eternal servant of Krishna. This is now the principle. And from that platform, standing on that platform, above the reality of the mundane world, we're looking down. We're looking down and we see so much commotion. Just see. Just look at that beauty. Just look at that attraction. Look how it's affecting me. Look how I'm drawn. Amazing. How powerful is this material energy that it can pull me so much? Amazing, amusing, interesting phenomena. We are perceiving these things. We are perceiving these things, but we are not allowing ourselves to be swept up in the stream, in the current of the events, just as a little piece of wood is swept away by the currents of a river. No. We decide ourselves. How deep do I go into these currents? Because I hold on to a chain. I don't know where's my chain, but here's my chain. We hold on to a chain very strongly. Just like in Haridwar, in India, if you go into the Ganga, people take their bath in the holy river Ganga, but it's no joke. The water is cold. Sometimes can be shocking, the cold, and it's very swift. The current is stronger than you think, and there are steps going into the water, and they are slippery. Slippery like anything. Under the water, you can just slip like anything. So everybody knows, don't think you are an Olympic swimmer. Don't think, the chain is for old people. The chain is for the beginners. The chain is for the ones who are not so expert. I don't have to hold on to my chain all the time. My chain, yes, I'll hold on to it sometimes, but not all the time. And Prabhupada saw the beads of a devotee hanging on the doorknob. And Prabhupada said, whose beads are crying here? And they were the beads of the GBC. Just see. Exposed. So, we take our shelter of these beads. They are with us. where we go, where we go, they go. Everywhere. Because we chant when we can. Not finished. Finished!
See you tomorrow!
Never finished. Never finished. No. So, we are looking. So, this initiation is a ceremony where we are meditating on eternity. And in all these different stages of life that we are going through, that will stay the same. Because we go through different phases of life. I see how people change radically in their life, and how their needs and priorities change radically in their life, and how everything that they held in value and esteem yesterday looks very different today. And I see that sometimes vows also look very different, that they look that they seem so natural. I saw devotees who were living in a temple, getting up at 2:30 every day, chanting most of their rounds before Mangal Aarti, full Mangal Aarti. After that, chant some rounds after Mangal Aarti. Then recite chapters of Bhagavad Gita, learn verses, and fell down flat again for the deities at the time of darshan, and jumped higher than everyone else in the Guru Puja. And always ask questions after hearing Bhagavatam class. Then I saw them again in the world, in a job, in a household, in rising late, maybe not chanting, maybe so many things change. The vows had somehow or other drifted away, the lifestyle had drifted away. And now it didn't make sense. Some felt, I cannot be helped to something that I promised when I was somebody else. I'm a new person now. I have changed. I'm no longer that person who took those vows, so I don't feel morally obliged. Good. You may not feel morally obliged, but you are karmically obliged, right? Because once taken a vow, cannot take it back. I thought I speak on vows because I'm preparing this week. I'm doing the last work on my seminar, which I'm supposed to teach in Radhavesh, which is called Living with Vows, and I have so much stuff on vows. And I happen to be here in Stockholm for vows as well. What a coincidence. So, somehow or other, this is the week of vows, you know? It's not that it's like that it all was planned like that, but it all comes together like that, so I take it Krishna's plan, so I may as well speak a bit on the topic. So, it's something to hold on to. It's something sacred, something to make it, to place it somewhere, like a treasure in our life, and to something to look after, just like jewels. You don't leave them lying around. Some people do, and then the next morning, my jewels, where are my jewels? The whole house, my jewels are gone. And yes, maybe the cleaning lady stole them, or who knows. the repairman who came for the fixing the bathroom. That who took the jewels, police case, never found. Jewels gone forever. Gift of grandma, right? The jewels of your grandma. They were not only valuable, but there was a sentimental value attached to them. Now, gone, forever gone. Chant Hanuman mantra and see if you get them back. Fine, you know, maybe, right? But what guarantee? So better look after. Better, if we have jewels, we should be careful and lock them away or put them away in a safe place. That is how we must deal with vows. We must keep them in a safe place, always. They must look after. We must. That is the means to deal with them. Because it's meant to be that this is our anchor, while life is changing. Sometimes, so much. You know, you cannot believe the difference when you are strong. When you're young, nothing in the world can touch you because you've got one thing, unlimited energy. Haha. And no matter what happens, right? You'll deal with it with unlimited energy and you don't care. We'll survive. We'll survive. We'll manage. We'll figure it out. Let's go from here to the other side of the world without money. We'll make it somehow or other. If we don't have money, we'll sleep outside somewhere in the forest. And if it rains, well, you know, we'll sit under a plastic sheet and stay up the whole night. Okay? And we'll make it somehow or other. And the next morning, the sun shines again, and we'll hitchhike, and we'll make it. Somebody will take us. And even if you get stuck, I got stuck once 3 days in Italy, but it was okay. It was next to a peach orchard. And boy, we ate peaches and peaches and peaches. I mean, I never ate so many peaches in my life. So, life is nothing but a peach. I got my quota of peaches. It was destiny. I was destined to have peaches, and I had them. So no anxiety. Then after 3 days, my peach quota was up, and yes, a car stopped and took us away. Right? It was a little car, very small, a Fiat 500. So we had to sit with the luggage on our back. Big backpacks, so I never did that again, big backpacks. I realized the smaller the backpack, the better. Yeah. So when you're young, ready to deal with things. But then, as the energy decreases, no longer so self-assured, no longer ready to deal with everything, maybe even needing some help, maybe even not able to deal with everything. Oh my God. Security. Sweden. Oh, love Sweden. Yes. Then suddenly, Sweden again. Oh yes. Nothing like home. So we go through so many different moods in our life, so many different experiences in our life. I have sometimes said that sometimes you're on top of the elephant and sometimes the elephant is on top of you. Right? Yes. As an analogy of life. Right? So, in the middle of this, we have our sacred vows, and we invest in them. And of course, the vows are ultimately meant to to take us to Krishna. And behind the vows, there is a spiritual master who plays a big part, because in that relationship, we can find love, we can find strength, we can find inspiration, we can find so much if we invest in it. So we must invest in it and be grateful with whatever we get in return. When one is relating to a spiritual master, one has to invest in the relationship as much as one can. And you never know what may come in return. After we slaved for 1 month to prepare, he did lean smile at me. Not even a smile. And one has to be grateful. God, we have to be grateful. One has to be appreciative. God, we slaved for 1 month. And we have to be appreciative. Not a word of thanks. God, you wouldn't do it to your dog. It's like, my God, what kind of person is this? We must serve. We must give everything. Selfless. And whatever comes, we must be grateful. And whatever doesn't come, we also accept, wait, patiently. And then whenever mercy comes, we will accept it. Not as something ordinary. Whatever attention, whatever way it comes, we never accept it as ordinary. Not easy. One has to tell the mind, because the mind is like tends to kind of take it ordinary at times. But we have to tell our mind, no, this is not ordinary. This is valuable. But if we invest in this relationship, then it becomes a great source of strength. Then it becomes a great inspiration in our spiritual life. And in fact, we realize that at one point, it's our only means to Krishna. It's our everything. Sometimes, in the beginning stages, people are also trying to see the relationship with the spiritual master as everything. But they are looking at what they can get from that relationship. And they are looking to kind of get the maximum attention, to kind of get a letter a day, to get a phone call in between, to get as much as possible, and milk. No, it is not like that. It is not like that. We must give to our spiritual master. It's what we give that is the key to the relationship. We must give ourselves wholeheartedly. And then whatever comes in return, that we accept, but then we are able to appreciate it. Then we are able to, if we have given ourselves in surrender and in service as much as we can, then we can also really, then we have the eyes to see the value of what comes in between. And then we have the eyes to take, and the strength, and the insight, the intelligence, to take advantage of the mercy we are getting. Otherwise, if we simply try to take, and are still not satisfied, I'm just not getting enough. I'm not getting enough mercy, I'm not getting enough association. How can I be expected to carry on like this? No, not like that. That is the neophyte stage. that should not exist after the vows. That may exist before the vows. After the vows, that should not exist anymore. After the vows, one has to go to the level of maturity in the relationship and become a servant and give, you know, and be grateful for what comes. Because one should know the spiritual master. It was Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur who first signed his letters with your ever well wisher. In that, and coined that English phrase. And it was Srila Prabhupada who made this phrase like at the very core of the relationship between him and his disciples. And therefore, we also are taking it at times, and we'll say, yes, you are ever well wisher, because that is the fact. That is the relationship.
Just like a parent with his child, looking down so
lovingly
at his little boy, full of affection, is well wisher.
How nice, he cries.
How nice.
Whatever. So like that. There's so much more on the topic, but I cannot spend all my energy in one night, nor all yours for listening and trying to digest whatever I say. So I want to come to the conclusion of the day. Let the conclusion be is that we see that that these rituals of initiation are meant to be a blessing. Whether they are the rituals of the African tribals, whether they are the rituals of any class of people in the world, or whether they are the rituals of a transcendental movement, they are a blessing. And that is it. And we should always look to take advantage of this blessing. They are like seeds that we put in the ground, and from this seed, now our bhakti should really grow. Just like at the time of initiation, one receives a lotus flower, but the lotus flower is closed. It's closed. And one has to open the leaves. I don't know if in Sweden you have so much experience with lotus flower, maybe not, right? But in India we do, right? In India we have lotus flowers. And we know you buy the lotus flower and generally it's closed, right? And you have to carefully peel the leaves open, right? And then you peel it open and then you have a very beautiful open lotus flower. And you offer to the deities like that. Sometimes we make garlands from the closed lotus flowers also. You will see the pictures where Krishna Balaram and Radhishyam Sundar in Vrindavan are wearing lotus flower garlands. Very nice. Anyway, so it is like a closed lotus flower, a great blessing. And when we go to work to open up its leaves, to use it for pure devotional service in all kinds of ways, use it to learn the science of devotional service, use it to chant the holy name with quality, use it to make Krishna consciousness our first priority in life. And still, we do all material duties as nice as we did before, but our interest has shifted. Now shifted interest. Then we can gradually open this lotus until it leads to deep and mature Krishna consciousness, where we develop deep attachment to Krishna, and gradually our love for Krishna can develop, and as it does, our Krishna consciousness becomes the most wonderful thing in the world. So now that was the end. And if there are any questions or comments, then I'll try. Yes, in the back. Yes. If you could speak a little louder, then I can hear. No, if Swedish, someone can translate it also.
I can try to translate.
Please. Why do we return if we have
good karma?
Good karma means we have done many good things in this world. And the result is that we are getting good karma. But doing good things in this world means, for example, we help people who need our help. That is good karma. Or there are people who are starving in the world, and good karma is that we try and really help them. Good karma means we relieve the suffering of others. All these things are good karma. But if we have not worked on our eternal relationship with the Supreme Lord, then even good karma will bring us back to this world. But then that good karma will give us a very good birth in this world. Maybe it takes us to higher planets, or we take our birth in a very good family. And that makes a big difference. If you take your birth in a very bad family, then you will have so many problems later in life, for sure. But if you get a very good family, naturally you will get the best opportunities. So good karma gives you that. But if you have developed your relationship, your eternal relationship with Krishna, then you are going beyond good karma, beyond bad karma, to the eternal level. So good karma can even take us to higher planets within this universe, and where life is much better, much longer, and very, very nice. But it cannot take us beyond birth and death. That you can only get from the eternal, from working for your eternal relationship with Krishna. So that's why we are always investing in that. We are chanting Maha Mantra, we're doing devotional service, we maintain a temple, and everyone who is regular is helping to look after the temple and the programs of the temple, and in that way we are doing our eternal service to Krishna. Because Krishna can manifest himself in the form of his deities. So he's here. So it's very easy. All we have to do is come here, there's Krishna. Personally present. So accessible. So the eternal is not difficult to reach. Right here. I'm all ear.
Hello.
Well, there was a comment.
He
said
about fear. Huh?
He says about what?
Fear.
Fear?
He hasn't understood. Or he didn't understand the English, so then he translated the answer for him.
Yeah.
Now he understood. Yeah. So good karma. Okay, somebody can translate sentence for sentence. Good karma gives you good birth. Good karma gives you good birth in the world. Bad karma gives you bad birth in the world. But if you serve the eternal Lord, then you can become free from birth and death. That is the point. Spiritual is not karma. That's not karma. When you do spiritual things, that's eternal benefit. Karma is temporary. It always changes. So, the result of material work is called karma. It is temporary. The result of eternal work is that you get eternal benefit. And from that, you become free from birth and death. Sorry, I don't speak Swedish. Huh? Sorry, I don't speak Swedish. Any other question? Yes.
Where is Dharma?
What is Dharma? We have karma and dharma. Dharma is a word which sometimes is translated as religion, sometimes it is translated as prescribed duty, sometimes it is also described as occupation. The roots of the word dhar means to hold, to contain, and therefore, it is sometimes referring to the essence of something. So it said the dharma of water is wet, the dharma of sugar is sweet, the dharma of summer is hot, the dharma of winter is cold, and so on. So dharma is the essential nature of something. It said the dharma of the living being is to be the servant of God. Just as sugar is sweet, a living being by nature is the servant of God. And when he's not acting like servant of God, he cannot be happy. So only until he accepts his dharma, that he is the eternal servant of God, can a living being be happy. That is dharma. Yes, sir. In which year was Prabhupada initiated? I think he met his spiritual master in 1922 and the initiation was in 1933. Isn't that correct?
Yeah.
He met his spiritual master first in 1922 and he accepted him at that time as his spiritual master in his heart, but the formal ceremony of Diksha took actually place in 1933. 1965. Then he had received sannyas. Sannyas he got when he was 59. No.
53.
Huh?
53.
No.
59, I think.
He was 59 years old, I think. So that must have been 1955. Sannyas. And that also makes sense because people go through this thing that Prabhupada 11-year cycles, right? I don't do this, but, you know, people do that. They say in 1922 he took he met a spiritual master. In 1933 he took initiation. In 1944 he published Back to Godhead. In 1955 he took sannyas. And in 1966 he founded ISKCON. And in 1977 he left this world. And we do these things. Anyway, I don't know about this. 1955, sannyas. Yes. A little louder.
There are vows in different modes of nature, and you said that one should not break his vow or her vow. So do you think if the vow was like an ignorance or impassion, should one keep this vow?
There are vows in different modes of nature, ignorance, passion, and so on, and if the vows are in a lower nature, should one keep such a vow? Well, we can look at the example of Srila Prabhupada's mother. She took certain vows to protect the life of her son. It is said that once she offered blood from her breast to a demigod, or a demigoddess, I'm not sure, god or goddess, to ask for protection for her son. It is said that also that she had a vow that she would eat when he was small, Abai was small, that she would eat only with her left hand, and that she would eat with her left hand until the day that he would ask why she was eating with the wrong hand and why she wasn't eating with the right hand, right, as one is supposed to eat by Vedic culture. And she was convinced that as long as he didn't ask, right, that he would keep on living. Right? So such vows are vows under the influence of the modes of material nature. They are not transcendental vows. Although the sentiment was very nice, that she wanted to make this kind of sacrifice for her son to live, these are not actually the kind of vows that I was referring to. Right? These are vows in the modes of material nature, and one is not bound to such vows. In fact, if one has taken such vows, one can easily leave them behind. Yeah? I had taken a vow that I would stay with this football club for 10 years, and only 6 have passed, so I cannot join the Hare Krishna movement because I have to stay 4 more years in the football club. Sorry, I took a vow. No, one can easily leave such vow. It is said, Devarsi Bhutaptaninam Pitrinam Nakik Karu Nayamri Sara Jam Sravatmane Saranam Saranyam Gato Mukundam Pariti Akata. This one I know very well. And it is said that somehow or other one is being relieved from all duties, from all vows, from all debts, when one takes shelter of Krishna. From all responsibility, all previous responsibilities, gone. When we take the responsibility to Krishna, then relieved from any other vow. So no more vows to the devas, the rishis, the demigods, the sages, to family and society, all these vows relieved from that. All other debts are paid. If you drink a glass of milk, you have a debt, a karmic debt to the cow. The cow has served you and you took advantage of, you owe something to that cow. In the next life, you have to serve that living entity. You have to pay it back. Some life later, but you have to pay it back. If not next life, then after. So we have so many debts. All debts gone. All vows gone. Everything gone. Only one thing left.
Krishna.
If you break your vow, it depends, because some vows are not good. You make a vow, if you make the wrong vow, then once you come to Krishna consciousness, yes, then it's good to break these wrong vows. They are wrong. They were taken when we didn't know what to do. So we committed ourselves to the wrong thing. So it's good to change it. Just like you go on your own and you doctor yourself. You have some problem and you go to and you buy some medicine and you start playing with it and you think, well, you adjust your diet, and then you go to a doctor and the doctor says, it's all wrong. That diet was all wrong. You have to change it. You have to now take this and this diet. Yeah? And then you must follow the doctor, yeah? Because he knows better. So saying we made a vow, but it was the wrong vow on our own. So once we come to the right person, to Krishna and his representative, then we know what the right vow is. Then we follow the right vow. Like that. So yes, you can give up these other vows. No problem. No.
Then one should suffer in hell. If you break your vow, which was in ignorance, then
no, if you break your vow in ignorance, it's good. Break it now. Keep only vows to Krishna. All your other vows, put your boots on. Stamp on them. Kick them out of the door. Beat them. Strangle them. Drown them. Burn them. Get rid of them. Spit on them. Give up all attachment to them. Disregard them as useless, as destructive, as negative, as what cannot help you. Goodbye. Okay. No, just holding the door. Yes. Now go ahead. Your turn. Loud and clear. One should not take vows in front of the deities.
But if one has some kind of desire to make a vow to help one in spiritual life.
No, we should not take vows other than under the guidance of the spiritual master. Because we alone, we don't know what vows we can take. You know? We don't know. We may think on our own, yes, I'm going to take this vow. But once you take such a vow under the guidance of an expert teacher who will accompany us as we're taking the vow, then it's safe. Not just all alone, you know, someone who comes and says, I will take a vow of celibacy. And it was here, I remember that there was one boy who had some vows here on his own. And I told him then also, I said, these vows you should not take, such vows you should not enter into, and you can be relieved from that vow by a spiritual master. And it's better that you take shelter of the spiritual master and ask him what to do now. Huh? Because your first vow should be to take shelter of a spiritual master, and he may relieve you from previous vows, just like that. And he'll take the responsibility to Krishna. Yes, I'll go on. He'll take the responsibility to Krishna, right? For that vow. Isn't it? You know, the fact that you're not following that vow, don't worry. Because if you don't follow it on his order, he will take whatever the responsibility for whatever reactions come. Even if someone has taken a vow in front of the deities, for which he was not ready. If one takes the shelter of the spiritual master can relieve us from this vow. So it's not from what will I do now, taking this vow, and I'm bound by it because it was in front of the deity forever. No, just take shelter of the spiritual master, he can relieve you like that in a moment. Yes?
Yes, I have a question from Robert here. If you use all your good karma here on earth,
yeah. Yeah, exactly. Once your good karma is used up, then you get the other reactions, the bad karma. So then in the next life, you will have to have a more difficult life. If he translates just sentence by sentence, it's the better way.
Yes, if you eat
sentence by sentence.
Yeah.
Only one sentence, no more.
If you eat
Yeah. So when you have used up your good karma, then you get your bad karma, and then while you are going through your bad karma and suffering, you can try and do good karma. And as it is now, we are all having bad karma. Because, you can translate it, in this age we all have bad karma. I'm not used to translating. If I need to work with a translator, better I work with a real translator, you know, tapas.
You know, sentence by sentence, because that goes 20 times quicker.
So then tapas can just tell me. He's more trained, you know, like there's a system that we use in translating, and the system is sentence by sentence, because otherwise it doesn't go anywhere. So my answer is that when you use up your good karma, then afterwards you will still have to suffer the reactions of your bad karma. And in this age, we all have bad karma. But even when you are suffering from bad karma, you can still do spiritual activity. And that's the only thing that can give you an eternal solution. So therefore, our main concern is not karma. Our main concern is to do eternal spiritual activity. Then automatically, if you do spiritual activity, all karma disappears. And that's really the solution. So we are not in the movement where we are trying to counteract bad karma with good karma. We are counteracting all karma, bad karma and good karma, with service to Krishna, by chanting His holy name, by taking Krishna prasad. And then we become free from all karma. Like if we take prasadam, that food is karma free. And not only is it karma free, it even makes us free from karma. So that is the way we deal with karma. We chant, we do service, and we take Krishna prasad. Hare Krishna mantra is the best way to become free from karma. He has many questions about karma.
I think
on every shell of
he's eating meat. That is it. Yeah, well, that is very intelligent that he's concerned about that, because it is true that you get yourself in trouble with that. So you have to stop it. Otherwise, I cannot guarantee you what karma you will get. And now you may think, well, I'll eat meat, but I'll also chant Hare Krishna, so then I will become free from the karma of eating that meat. But in the matter of chanting Hare Krishna, there are some offenses you can make against the mantra, and then it doesn't work. And one of the things is when you engage in sinful activities
and you use the mantra to get rid of the karma, then it doesn't work. So if we eat meat and we think, oh well, I'll chant Hare Krishna to get rid of the bad karma, no, sorry, it doesn't work. If you eat meat, you will always get bad karma. Anyone who eats meat always gets bad karma. We cannot help that. That cannot be helped. So it's very important to stop it. Okay, well, I have a question on this side. We want to thank Tapas for the translation. I want to now give some other people the chance, and then I want to end the class.
You're mentioning those devotees who are very fired up in the ashram and chanting and waking up early in the morning. And for example, you have a spiritual vision in some way to see their spiritual account. For example, if you compare them with somebody who comes here and does a little bit every day, what is more beneficial? Because they were serving like very, very nice and very good, like 5 years or 10 years, and they fall off. And then
only Krishna can judge. That we cannot judge what is more beneficial. Krishna will decide at the end who has pleased him the most. Because the benefit from devotional service, it's not that everything goes into your spiritual bank account and more, and then you come at a certain level, and then bingo, you get the prize, the mercy of Krishna. No. It just, it goes, and Krishna decides when he's satisfied with your service. So we'll never know who will get the favor of Krishna, or what service weighs the most to Krishna. But we should not play, we should not play with the material energy. You know, it's like the mice are sitting in the hole and they're looking at the cat. And there is one mouse, and he's saying, yeah, I'll show you guys, you know, and shoop, out the hole, and shoop, back in the hole. You know? Don't do that. Right? Don't do that. The cat's very fast. Very fast and tricky, you know. Don't do that. No. Stay away from the cat. You know, that's, whatever we do, watch out for the cat. Maya is very, very powerful, very, very fast. Nipitistavayantara or Maya is waiting always nearby, ready to slap you down as soon as you flirt with the material energy. Watch out. So let us try and become fixed in the regulative principles. If we, and chanting around, if we cannot, then let us work for Krishna steadily and try and come to the principles, like in this way. But ultimately you have to come to that point, you know, of these principles. And better we do it this life than the next. And then at one point you may say, okay, now let me fix myself. So these four regulative principles, 16 grounds, are very essential if you want to go back to Godhead this lifetime. We have to. It's really important. Can't miss the boat. Okay, last. Is it true that because somebody... Yeah?
It's true. So you should never touch anybody's feet.
Well, no, if you touch the feet of someone, you give your karma to someone.
Yeah, but
So you should touch someone's feet. You give away your karma. But he should not, he or she should not let you touch the feet. You know.
Oh, then it's also a relief for me.
Yeah, you get free from karma, you give to someone else. In this way, you sometimes see devotees trying to touch each other's feet. Yeah. Holding each other up. Rolling over the ground. But we should not go for this too much. But sometimes I go. If someone touches your feet, yeah, you can get karma. It can be dangerous for you. So don't let people touch your feet.
What is the
difference between bowing down? What is what? The difference between bowing down to a person and touching somebody, that person. And there is a difference, but even when you bow down to a person, there is some transfer of karma. Yeah. Someone bows down to you. But you touch the head, you give it back. So someone touches the feet, you give it back. But you gently touch the head. Like I know someone, they touch the feet and then really touch the head. You know? Not like that. Yeah. Like
so it would be a bad job,
like feet massage. Feet massage. It says that generally speaking, amongst devotees, we do not allow someone to touch our feet who is not initiated.
Somebody who's initiated would be a blessing.
Well, not a blessing also, but there's less karma because the karma has already been. There's not at least fresh sinful reactions. Yeah? But someone who's in the world, not following four regulated principles. So, generally, that's the standard. But even then, you know, so foot massage, yeah, someone is doing a big foot massage to cure you of the disease of today, and with that gives you karma, which will give you the disease of tomorrow. Therefore, you take only from the Vaishnavas, only from a devotee, because then you become a devotee.
But isn't prasadam pure, whatever?
Prasadam is pure, yeah. Oh, you said prasadam, yes, prasadam, true. Prasadam is pure.
For instance, if you...
It's pure.
If someone has left a sweet and is about to throw it, and you take it.
Yeah, it's pure. If you have faith like that, prasadam is prasadam. And in the beginning, devotees used to do that, you know, eat the remnants of the guests on the Sunday feast. But generally, we take only the remnants of the Vaishnavas, because that's the special Mahamaha that we are after. So to, by accident, touch the feet of a Vaishnava, or to steal something off his plate, sometimes this happens in the pastimes of devotees, maybe today. Okay.
You saw Sannyasi comes for giving lecture and he takes prasadam. And after he takes prasadam, some devotee goes around with Mahamaha. Is it sinful to refuse? For example, it's like, I don't want to eat after. Some people are like this.
It's better not to refuse. Because we should respect the sannyasis. So, why refuse?
So you should cross over this mental...
If possible. Yeah. Little honor. But if you don't take it for some reason, you know, then fold your hands to it. And at least offer respects to it.
Yes,
if you don't take it for some reason, whatever that reason is, then second best, not as good as taking it, but second best is to offer respects. In the Chaitanya Charitamrita, there's a story of Kalidas who took remnants of prasad from every Vaishnava in Bengal. And by doing that, he got more mercy than any of his other Vaishnavas. So, in the Chaitanya, in the Srimad Bhagavatam, it's described that Narada Muni took the remnants of food from the Bhakti Vedanta devotees who visited his house during the rainy season when he was a boy, and he took these remnants, and it said in that way he developed the same qualities as the Bhakti Vedantas. But in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, we see that Kalidas even developed more. He got more mercy than the people he took the remnants from. So taking remnants of Vaishnavas is quite something. But not from the Maya. Okay, I am now running out of steam. Getting tired, brain tired. So more tomorrow. Thank you very much. Ki jai.